Moncrief on News Talk.
Jonathan De Burka Butler is here once again to bring us some news from other parts of the world. Jonathan, good afternoon.
Sean, how are you going on?
Switzerland we're going to go to first. This is an interesting one, and perhaps, you know, against the trend in most other countries, they're going to vote on capping the population.
Yes, you know, Switzerland loves its referendums.
It does,
and
it loves
its direct democracy. They have four dates a year where they do these referendums, right? And one of the ways they can do this is by coming up with what they call, I think, a popular initiative, which is where they get people to sign petitions or whatever, and if that goes over 100,000, then it goes to a referendum, okay? Mm. In this particular instance, this has been proposed by the Swiss People's Party, they're on the right of the spectrum, okay? And they have the most seats in Parliament. And they've got enough signatures now to put the issue to a national ballot on the 14th of June. And what they're proposing is that they want to cap, as you say, the population to 10 million. It's not allowed to get to 10 million before 2050. And should it reach even 9.5 million before 2050, the government would have to take steps to limit the population through changes to asylum applications, family reunification, residency permit issuance, and even renegotiating international agreements such as Schengen, which would obviously get them into trouble with you know, European partners. I know they're not in the European Union, but they do have partners in Europe. They say the reason for this is because they want to help protect the environment, natural resources, infrastructure, and the social safety net. Nothing to do at all with the colour of people's skin or anything like that, they assure us. But this is a party who have historically always been involved in trying to cap the number of migrants coming into the country.
Right, so the measure seems to be specifically aimed at migrants. What's the birth replacement rate in Switzerland?
Oh, God, I normally know that, but I don't know what the birth replacement rate is in Switzerland, right? The current population is 9.1 million.
Yeah.
And the people who don't like this proposal are saying, look, we don't have enough workers here. We don't have enough people in our hospitals. We don't have enough construction workers, so on and so forth. So we need these people to come in.
Yeah.
Now, a good 30% of the population is already made up of people who were not born in Switzerland.
Okay.
And given that it's surrounded by lots of European countries, France, Germany, Italy, Austria, Italy in particular, would probably send an awful lot of workers up to Switzerland.
Okay.
I don't really know what the real motive is behind it.
Well, I mean, one can infer it's an I'm wondering why you asked about the replacement rate was that, okay, you're limiting the amount of migrants coming into the country, but what happens if there's a huge spurge of baby making among the Swiss? Do they start telling women you can't have babies because we have to keep the population under a certain level?
It's a great question, absolutely. And I have to say, I had a look at a good few articles. That question hasn't actually come up. It's really interesting.
Okay, well, a wide assumption it won't come up then.
Well, indeed.
Is it likely to pass?
This is the scary thing. It looks like it might. I was traipsing around looking for opinion polls on this. I only found one or reference to one. And apparently this poll says that 48% of the population will say yes, 41% will say no, and 11% are undecided. It should be said that in order for this to pass, it needs a majority of the general population, but also I think 20 out of 26 cantons have to vote in its favour. It's kind of like a weighted system, which is fair enough.
Yeah.
We'll see how that goes. Definitely worth watching there to see how that goes in the summer.
Okay, right. Oh, it's in the 14th of June, it's going to happen. Yeah, we'll find out about that a little while after that. Right, France we're going to go to, and the poor old Louvre again. It seems to have the worst security.
Jimmy Mac, it's having a terrible time. Between the heist from last October and then they had a water leak that damaged all these ancient books and they had strikes. Well, I suppose it's France, so you have to factor that in always. But now they have launched an investigation into a ticket fraud that's been going on for the best part of 10 years, apparently.
Oh, no.
10 years they've been getting away with this. So it came to the attention of internal investigators, we'll call them, back in December of 2024, when they noted that there was two Chinese guides who had been acting suspiciously. And so the investigation was launched. And they've since found that there was a fully fledged network that may have let in up to 20 groups of tourists per day over the period of about 10 years. And so far, 9 people have been arrested, right? So that's 2 people who worked in the Louvre, 2 officials there, several guides, and 1 person who they describe as the organizer of the ring. And what they reckon was happening was there is single tickets that are issued, and these were simply getting recycled. They were coming back in using the same tickets, and they were giving kickbacks to the guys on the door.
Right, as simple as that. Yeah, rather than there was some sort of electronic fiddle that they...
Well, this is the thing. I haven't seen anything about an electronic fiddle in here. I don't know how the ticketing system at the Louvre works exactly. But if they were using the paper system, look, it gets so busy in these places. I know from my own experience, having worked in the British Museum and also spent a lot of time in the Vatican, that you've got throngs of people going through, and often with groups, they'll just open up the side gate and say, okay, fire you through. So it might have been easy to get away with it. Apparently it was, because, as I said, 10 million quid has gone missing.
Oh my! So presumably the organisers of these trips, the supposed organisers, were charging groups of tourists, Chinese tourists, taking the money off them, but then just using the same tickets.
And the tourists assumed that they were part and parcel of the buying of the ticket, and but it never got to the Louvre anyway.
Okay, that's oh gosh! And they've had the poor old Louvre then is out of pocket severely because of this. I imagine they're struggling as it is.
10 million, they are struggling, and they've had to. It got quite a bit of coverage actually. I think they had to raise the prices of the tickets for non-EU citizens. So it's up to €32 now for non-EU, which is still pretty good, to be honest.
Yeah,
with
I suppose. The Philippines we're going to go to now, where there's been a court ruling in favour of same-sex couples.
Yes, they don't they don't recognise same-sex relationships in the Philippines, and they don't have divorce in the Philippines either, except if you're Muslim, actually. And there's a decent minority Muslim population there. And obviously that causes problems. And this particular story came about when a same-sex couple, both women, they were living together in Manila. They were very happy, bought a house together. But in order to get the paperwork through, they only put the name down of one person on the deeds of the house, right? Because they weren't married, because they couldn't be legally, and they weren't related through blood. So when the happiness ended and the relationship fell apart, they decided to live apart. And the initial idea was to sell the house and split the funds, okay? But one of the people changed their mind. One of the women changed their mind. The one who had her name on the deeds, obviously.
Yes.
And so her former partner took her to court, and went to a lower court, and they said, no, nothing we can do about this because we don't recognise co-ownership as such. That went to an appeals court, and they affirmed that decision from the lower court. But the Supreme Court last week has basically said, no, you're both wrong. And what we're going to do here is we're going to allow the property to be sold and for the other person to get the 50% of the property. And what they're saying here, and what's interesting about this, is that this was ruled under what they call the family code in the Philippines, right? And that does define marriage as a bond between a man and a woman. But there is an article in it, Article 148, which I'll quote from, and that governs, quote, property relations of people who live together but cannot legally marry. Now, when that legislation was put together, I imagine what they envisaged was that this was for people who were separated.
Yeah.
You can get separation in the Philippines. It's very difficult. But this was for people who were separated. And then they went on. They had another relationship. And let's imagine that fell apart.
Yeah.
And then property became an issue. But their interpretation is really interesting, because the Supreme Court has said that this law does not discriminate based on gender. So they're not referring to sexuality. They're saying based on gender. So they're saying the law doesn't care if you're a man or a woman, doesn't care about your sexuality. It needs to be the same for everyone. So therefore, it applies to all forms of cohabitation. So let's get on with selling the house and splitting the funds.
I imagine that's a wildly controversial interpretation of that clause within the Philippines, given that it wasn't intended for that purpose.
I have to say, I am guessing that it wasn't intended for that purpose, but this is the beauty of the law. And this is the beauty. This is a classic Supreme Court judgment, taking what's written down and taking it literally. And in their decision, they've gone back and they've basically said, look, this is it's a classic Supreme Court judgment. They're saying to the governments and to the legislators, they're saying, this is a problem that you didn't foresee. Mm. You now need to go back, note that things have changed culturally in the Philippines, and come up with legislation or ways that situations like this can be avoided.
That'll be interesting.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see. But it's a very interesting decision, and it is really, for that community, it's a big moment in the Philippines.
Yeah, there has been any response, as far as you know, from government circles, Philippine government circles?
I haven't seen anything, to be honest,
yeah,
no.
Yeah, because that mightn't be their response to indeed. This. You know, they might think, see it as a loophole. Right, Bangladesh we're going to go to next, where the BNP have won rather convincingly. Now, this is... this election, why is it being referred to as the first proper election in years? What's been going on there?
Good question. So back in August of 2024, you might remember there was a popular revolution. They called it a Gen Z revolution, which lasted for a couple of months, and they ended up getting rid of the woman who was prime minister there for the guts of 15 years, Sheikh Hasina. And she, as you can imagine, wasn't particularly popular. She was very corrupt, and she was, they had three elections basically, and she was returned overwhelmingly in all of those elections. And there was a lot of question marks. There was a great quote actually in one of the pieces that I read from a guy who said he stopped going to elections because every time he turned up, somebody else had already voted. So that gives you an indication of what it was like. So they had enough. The economy was doing really badly after the pandemic and lots of things like that. And they managed to get rid of her. Now, 14 people died, 1,400 people died in the meantime.
Yeah.
But they did get rid of her. An interim government came in. And so now they've hosted these, held these elections. And the new party, as you say, the BNP, which is the Bangladeshi Nationalist Party, led by Tariq Rahman, won overwhelmingly. So they came back with 221 seats out of 300 that they could get in parliament. So like a 2/3 majority. Now, I don't know if they need that for constitutional changes or whatever. I'm not sure. I'm just saying that for me, that 2/3 majority is huge.
Yeah.
And so it's a real mandate to bring about change. The only thing is that for some people, he's not really an emblem of change because he comes from a political dynasty. His own mother... before Sheikh Hasina was prime minister, I think she was prime minister either twice or three times. His father was president. He was assassinated in 1981. He's kind of a cult figure from the independence movement in Bangladesh. So,
and he was in exile, wasn't he?
He was. He was away for 17 years. Now, he was away because he was being investigated for corruption, which he said, of course, was politically motivated. Now, it's interesting that it tallies with the timeline that Sheikh Hasina was in power.
Yeah.
And she may or may not have been encouraging those investigations into him. But he's back now. He's been back since December, and he will be leading Bangladesh for the foreseeable future. And they could do with it because they're in the horrors. Inflation is through the roof. Debt is through the roof. Their foreign reserves have been cut in half, I think, in the last 4 years. And their garment industry, which was made up, I think, 80% of their exports, is gone, essentially, really stalled.
And interesting then that Sheikh Hasina was the leader of the BNP and prompted these...
So she was a different party. She was with the Awami League. Interesting you mention it, because she was with the Awami League, but they were actually barred from this particular election.
Right,
which is interesting in itself. And it's their followers said, oh, we're not going to turn up anyway because we wouldn't want to vote for anybody else. But that wasn't what other voters felt. I mean, the comparison in terms of turnout, voter turnout this time around was 60%. And the last election was only 42%. So you get a general feeling here that there was a widespread desire for change.
A sense
that
things might actually change.
Hopefully.
And the constitutional reform, any idea what kind of changes they may be?
So the one constitutional reform that they're bringing in, and that also that was held on the same day, a vote on that, that's going to pass as well. I think it got 63%. The big thing there is to limit prime ministerial terms to two. So that'll be interesting.
Yeah. Okay. And Sheikh Hasina, where are they?
She's in India. The Indians, that's another strand
to
this whole thing.
That seems to be a Bangladeshi tradition. As soon as you leave lose an election, you flee the country.
Yeah, no, she was actually, I think she's been sentenced to death. For what she did during that uprising, and she scarpered, and she's now in India, which is another story in itself, because relations between India and Bangladesh aren't great as a result.
To put it mildly, should say. Right, finally, we'll return back to Europe and Italy, where Giorgia Meloni's face was immortalized but is no more.
Yeah, it's a wonderful
story.
It's a weird story. Yeah, it's a great story. So there's a lovely church in one of hundreds in Rome called the Basilica of San Lorenzo in Lucina. It's in between the Spanish Steps and the Pantheon, and you go down little alleyways and get to the Pantheon. It's a great little walk if you're ever there. And this particular individual, this artist, Bruno Valentinetti, 83-year-old, he had painted the ceiling of this particular church in 2000, or part of it. And he was called back because there had been some water damage, and he had to do touch up or whatever. And he decided while he was up there that he would replace the face of a cherub in this ceiling with the face of Giorgia Meloni. And this was spotted by someone, and I think late last month it was reported by Repubblica, and he denied it, said, "Oh, I know nothing about it." Now, the pictures of it started going around, and it was clearly of her. So he was interviewed again, and he admitted, yes, okay, I did actually do it, and it was of Giorgia Meloni. The reason he did it is fascinating. He said in an interview that he like old masters, he likes to insert jokes into his work. And that's why
they did.
I mean, there's a great story of Michelangelo in The Last Judgment. When he was painting that, there was a guy by the name of Biagio de Cesana, who was the MC, Master of Ceremonies for the Papal Court when Michelangelo was doing this, and he didn't like The Last Judgment, so Michelangelo put him into the thing and put donkey's ears on his head and wrapped a snake around him, which bit him on the penis. So there is a history of that. You know, Caravaggio did it a lot as well. And so, you know, he's keeping up a tradition, I suppose.
Yeah. Has it been removed or is it still
there? It has been removed, yeah. It's been taken away now. He was asked to remove it, although I don't know if he did it himself, but it is now gone. And he said that he was compelled by the Vatican to do so. And so there it sits.
Now, but was his intention... Was he satirizing Meloni?
I don't know.
Or was it a tribute to her?
I don't know. I don't know him that well. The only thing I know about him is he's 83. And he said that, you know, he liked to insert jokes into his work. Now, she made a comment herself on it saying that she's certainly no angel.
Yeah.
And in classic Giorgia Meloni style, she just kind of laughed it off.
Okay.
But of course, there was, you know, other political parties who, you know, tried to make hay out of it, saying that this is propaganda, this harks back to the time of Mussolini, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, this can't be done.
Okay.
Is
there a widespread review of his work now to see if they find the faces of any other politicians in there?
I don't know, but there has been some changes to how this particular church will be restored and decorated in the future, according to the Religious Building Fund of the Interior Ministry, who looks after this.
Right, so what's going to happen in the next week?
Okay, so tomorrow Mark Zuckerberg is testifying in that case in California around social media. This is... not a class action, but an individual action or whatever, which has been brought in social media. It's around addiction. I don't know if you read about it.
Yeah, and he's saying there's no evidence.
Basically. So that'll be very interesting, because they're saying that this will be sort of a totemic case,
if you can say that, a test case.
And so we'll see. That's something worth watching. Then on Wednesday, the Danish King Frederick X is visiting Greenland. Timing is very interesting, Sean. I don't know why he's doing it now. And then, speaking of that, Trump's Board of Peace. President Trump's Board of Peace is holding its inaugural meeting on Thursday.
Yeah. It's like the kind of meeting of all the bad guys in the Marvel universe, or the, you know.
No comment, Sean.
Not that I'm making any comment on that. Anyway, Jonathan, thanks a million as ever. Jonathan de Burke, Butler there.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.